This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Ubermensch. She has a background in modeling, and I guess she's kind of become like a Twitter shit poster. But yeah, Bimbo, it's great having you on, and I'm also joined here
Thank
with Matt Pegas.
Here.
Hi.
How did you go from the modeling background to the online discourse? And you're not really affiliated with like one particular scene. I guess some people might try to say like Dirtbag Left. But you're just more of a kind of an outside observer as far as politics go, just more observing social trends commentary. Can you kind of give our audience some background information?
Yeah, I think that you kind of got it like way more than a lot of other people, because I think the reason why I got on Twitter is in part because of the lockdown and everything, and because of that, I just was like, let me utilize this dormant account that I had since college. And I was on Instagram. I still am for my personal stuff. But what happened was I had another account on there that got yeeted. And I noticed that as a platform, Instagram was more censorious. So I was like, okay, it's time to go onto Twitter, just have fun on there. And I didn't intend for my account to go up in any way, shape, or form. It was like under 100 followers, but then I just said whatever I wanted to say, and I think I sound like a normal person, but for some reason, I guess, yeah, people follow the account, whatever.
Do you get people like calling you like the trad thought meme, and like the kind of response of like appealing to Simpson within the dissonance sphere?
That's a really good question. I think no, I don't get called that per se. I didn't even know there was a bimbo scene or a trad thought scene. I literally got on there and I was like, okay, bimbos are uber mentioned too, and then that's how the username got started. But no, I don't really think I'm exactly trad thoughty. I don't think people associate me with that because I'm not like obsequiously groveling to just, you know, a collective of, I think I'm more Lindy than I fucking hate using these words, man.
Yeah, I hear that meme Lindy a lot, but is there like a clear definition?
There's no clear definition, but I think it's just like, what's something, because think about it. The people on Twitter are very online all the time. So, you know, they're deconstructing things that other normal people just know are inherent truths, you know, like, When I was hanging out with this girlfriend today who I met online, she basically said, yeah, you know, like there was this thread I found and they were talking about marriage and relationships and they were using this really weird abstract language and stuff. But, you know, that's what people intuitively think if they're normal and not like fucking autistic. And it's true. It's like most people, maybe in the future, whatever weird Fabian monstrosity of like no one has a family and no one has kids and we all make our kids in a vat and everything is gonna happen. But right now, I think even as fucked up as shit is, people kind of intuitively know, you know, they just get married and they have one or two kids. But then you have these autists online who like break shit down and like fucking weird distended sort of, you know, almost scholarly language that's just kind of extraneous or whatever.
Yeah, academia has become a kind of a joke, so the sort of online autists have sort of filled that void, as like yeah, the sociologist for society.
Yeah, in some ways it's like they are their own weird cathedral that's a deviant cathedral from the cathedral itself. But they also use this weird sort of language and verbiage that you would kind of see as monastic or whatever.
Yeah, I think you bring up an interesting point that a lot of the online discourse is saying and sometimes over-explaining these things that are that basically everyone knows on some intuitive level. At its best, in defense of some of the online autists, I think that at its best, some of the conversations and threads you see about social dynamics, to an extent, they're naming stuff that everyone knows on an intuitive level. But at the same time, I think I'm trying to think of a specific example, but it kind of brings to light things. So the most insightful people will point to things that people may know on some level, but there's still value in giving words to it because it's for either politically incorrect or socially frowned upon to discuss some of those dynamics, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So they're talking about stuff that every, like, well-adjusted people, you know, kind of intuitively know, but at the same time, they're just like, it's almost like an aphorism of sorts, because every tweet is essentially an aphorism or a proverb, like a good one. And, you know, they're just like basically encapsulating what these things mean to all of us, but in like 240 characters or less.
Can you talk about your modeling background? How long were you a model, and like thoughts on the modeling industry? Who buys? Who is it being marketed to? And you kind of see these like political celebrities like Ella M. Hoff and Mina Harris getting into modeling now. And thoughts on the glamour and like where beauty standards have gone to, like the overall industry and like your background.
Okay, well, I was basically a diversity hire. Because as we all know, you know, the advertising wants ethnic ambiguity. I have the face of global liquid modernity, whatever. But what happened was I met my now spouse, then boyfriend online. Sam, go out of here. You're such a troll doll. Like, swear. Sorry, he's making moaning sounds with that scene. Shit for brain. But anyways, what was I saying? So I went from North Carolina to Toronto because I graduated from college and everything. And then I was like, okay, bye. It's time to grow up. I'm in Toronto and living with this man. And I'm like, okay, what do I want to do with my life? I was a fucking public policy major, which is like poli-sci without the teeth. And I'm like, okay, I want to do some fucking bimbo shit. I'm going to go into fashion. So I was loitering at a hotel listening, because I was there for a skin event, like a skincare event. And I was there, and then there was this lady who's a cosmetic chemist. And she was very intriguing and beautiful and statuesque. And she was talking about how she had a career pivot from being a like a model to going into skincare. So I was talking to her because I found her intriguing. And I'm 22 and I was like, oh, you know, I'm like an old maid. Like, you know, I wasn't thinking about modeling. I mean, people said it like casually growing up, like, oh, you know, your daughter could be a model because she's like fucking tall and lanky and she looks like a beanstalk. So, you know, whatever. But I was talking to this woman. Turns out she was a model and she was like, yes, you know, actually, you could be a model. Here's this lady I know. Her name is she told me her name. I've just realized I'm here and I'm like probably. Anyways, she told me her name, this mother agent. She connected me with her. I met up with the mother agent. She was like, you could have done well in the 80s, but you have hips, so you need to lose some weight off your hips, like an inch or two. And then I went to this competition, and I was like the oldest broad there because everyone else was like, it was like toddlers and tiaras, but for adolescents because they were all like 14, 15, 13 even. And I was like the oldest one woman except for like this one like silver fox of a broad on the in the thing, the competition. And then I won the competition along with some other girl, and yeah, that's how the modeling began. And then I went to Paris, and then I went to New York, and blah blah blah. But like, I was supposed to just be doing a lot of commercial work, and then bam, lockdown hit, and China virus hit, or whatever the fuck. And then Twitter. Well, I was on Instagram first, and then it came on Twitter. So that is the synopsis. I'm sorry I fucking rambled. But yeah, and my thoughts on beauty and stuff.
Oh yeah, like these political, like sort of like what's going on. Like, who is the modeling industry marketed to now? And there has been like a big, kind of a big change. Like it's become, even from the zero zeros, like what's considered glamorous has changed, and it's been more about these kind of social media celebrities or political icons, like the example of Mina Harris.
Yeah. So I mean, we all know this. Like the market and capital and the political economy shifts to whoever buys stuff. And what demographic buys stuff? It's people who want to leverage some sort of social capital. And I mean, that's the case with Ella Emhoff and Mina Harris and stuff like that. Or, you know, the political economy has taken into account that, you know, it's like, oh, you know, well, let's have like really fat people, or let's like have brown people, because you know that's what's selling, because the there's been demographic shifts, so they're like, okay, let's change what we're selling. And yeah, I mean, there's been a deviation in some ways, because it's crazy to think that like your average girl in the 90s would be too big for like straight fit modeling now.
Like in the late 90s, it was like all skinny and all blonde.
Well, yeah, like there was in the early 2000s and late 90s, you definitely saw like this appreciation for women from, you know, who were Slavic or like Eastern European, you know, or women like that. But then there's been a shift to, you know, women other parts of the global South, like, you know, hot, beautiful girls from Brazil. Like that's what we've been seeing, instead of like the south of Brazil where they're more like Germanic, you know, Euro admixture. They've been from the north, like Bahia or Fortaleza, and people, I mean, quite frankly, who look like I look. So there's been a shift to that sort of ambiguity. In some weird death cult way, it's just like, oh, you know, like,
but I guess there's a kind of transition in between, because I remember, so in the late 90s, it was all skinny, all blonde. Then, in maybe about 10 years ago, it was like lighter skin ethnic women, but sort of handpicked. And then now, like, the modeling industry is aggressively, like, as woke as possible. I think, like, the right-wing Twitter was, like, flipping out about the Calvin ads, about, like, the large African-American woman in the Calvin ads, and that's kind of explicitly woke stuff.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. I mean, even with the 90s, you saw the likes of Yasmin Ghari and, like, you know, Naomi Campbell. Like, I mean, I think a beautiful woman is a beautiful woman, and I think we kind of, like, intuitively know that stuff with, like, a golden ratio, whether she's very, like, fair, or whether she's swarthier, or whether she's just like indigo, you know, black, right? Like, you can kind of tell what women just, I really feel like that's just like a perennial truth. You can kind of just tell which women are like indicative of like health and beauty and whatever, you know, even if you saw somebody who's more Rubenesque, like, you just know that that's a beautiful woman, even if beauty standards have shifted. But, like, I think there's just this explicit, like, death cult tendency now to just love what's fucking ugly or, like, on the precipice of death. Like, you know, you either see somebody that looks like they're fucking about to die, like, sexless, like, androgyne, not even in a vitalistic way, like a David Bowie or Grace Jones type. And then, or you have like really fucking fat subcutaneous lard piece of person. And it's just like, it's just to make people feel better. It's like some weird fucking Harrison Bergeron sort of mentality, if that makes any sense. But yeah.
You brought up an interesting point earlier, that modeling, I know nothing about this topic, as you might be able to guess, but modeling, you know, in terms of fashion, in terms of the advertising agency, has always been about selling things, and obviously beauty sells, but also I think you said something to the effect earlier that, you know, people want to buy into things that signify social status in some way. And right now in the culture, that has a lot to do. I don't want to say wokeness because that's, you know, it's an overused term, but it has to do with, you know, images which sell the idea that you are inclusive seems to be.
Well, yeah, that's
consumers go for. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what, like, the political economy at this stage in our lives is kind of subsuming and co-opting or whatever and embracing. It's like some sort of weakness, and it is a Babylon belief of sorts. And, you know, it's just like pretty explicit. And I feel like I'm just saying what a lot of other people aren't saying and noticing, but, you know, it's just kind of, you know, true. And it's also taking into consideration who buys stuff. Like, I feel like there's more of an impetus to cater towards people and to make people want to think of themselves as like an atomized individual, you know, instead of thinking about a couple or like a family. It's like thinking about yourself and you as
yeah,
an individual.
Like everything, like even like what's described as woke culture, a lot of it is just a consumer choices as like, well, it's hyper individualism, but for the most part, it's just you buy an identity.
Yeah, it's a narco liberalism on steroids, basically. Like you don't have any agency as a person, especially not with your wallet, and so you can't make certain decisions, right? So it's like, what do you have to leverage for social capital? It's like your race, it's like whether you have a penis or not, it's, you know, whether or not you are mentally disabled. It's, you know, you kind of like pick and choose. It's like you're at you know, at a buffet, and you kind of pick and choose what you want to be. And it's like a great way to, it's a way for people to do that when they have so little, when their lives are so bereft of any meaning. That's like the direction they go in.
Yeah, like what you consistently see, both probably in mainstream modeling and advertising, but also with influencers and stuff, it's always the idea that, like, you as an atomized individual are making it in some way. Like, you're you have all these, you know, characteristics about you, what, you know, racial or LGBTQ-wise or whatever, and like you're living your best life. Like, that's the rallying cry, and it's, yeah, it's an atomized thing. It's appealing to people as atomized individuals living their best life. That's what I always, that's the idea that I feel like I'm constantly being sold, and I feel like I'm encouraged to buy things based upon the idea that somehow this will, like, self-actualize. I mean, that's probably a trend that's been going on since the 60s, but it's, you know, especially this last decade, you see it a lot.
You have an ambiguous look for the modeling industry, so where do you fit in with this whole intersectionality? Like, like these labels, like white, bi-POC, or white adjacent, where do you fit in with that? I think you mentioned you're like Mizrahi Jewish.
Yeah, my background's a little bit complicated, but there was some potential, like, carrot ancestry, and I went through an Orthodox Gyor process, but I grew up Coptic. But I never, like, if people ask me online, I'm like, that would actually, if in order for me to not lie to you, I would have to, like, go through my whole life story, and I don't want to fucking do that, because it's online, and I don't fucking know you.
Oh, so you're from an Egyptian Christian background, because I thought you had a connection to Israel because of the Hebrew letters on your Twitter.
No, a friend actually made that for me, but I did go through an like a conversion process and dunked through a mikvah and studied Hebrew. So that's why I know how to read Hebrew. It took a very long fucking time. But yeah, that's why I know Arabic. That's why I was part of another semi-ethno-religious minority and then basically switched to another. And it's probably why I could write like a Coptic version of Portnoy's Complaint, but call it Portnoy's Complaint with a P instead of a B.
Do Coptics, do they count as African Americans?
This is another great question. This is another quandary that I had to navigate when I was a young girl. I just put other. Because I don't think let's be real, I don't register as, like, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or even Italian, or maybe Sicilian if you're desperate and you're like just trying to lie. But no, I just put other. I didn't really feel comfortable saying I was African American, you know, even though I'm an African, not an African. You know, it's just like, I would not feel comfortable as like a daughter of two brain drain immigrants, like attaching myself to a group of people who went through chattel slavery or who's in Jim Crow and whatever. They literally are both doctors. And I, you know, there's like no fucking way. It's actually disgusting. It's like when Igbo Nigerians.
Oh yeah, you probably do get that with in Canada. Like you do get that with a lot of like high skilled immigrants, like Nigerians or Indians.
Yeah, it's like the worst mutation of Western liberalism. It's really disgusting when somebody who comes from, you know, a family where they make six figures, seven figures, make even more than like the native population of the countries they're moving to, they try to acquire valor of the people who are poorer than them. Like these are not the same material realities at all. And for you to claim valor or like victim status, because even though you're a part of a group of people that in some ways are very comparable to American Ashkenazi Jews, like it's not the same. You're not incarcerated the same way. Your ancestors did not go through fucking chattel slavery. It's literally not the same thing. So that's why I didn't feel comfortable going with African American.
Yeah, you're in Toronto now, and obviously they had a pretty draconian lockdown. But like, what are your thoughts on Canada as a post-national nation? Sort of the image of Toronto. Yeah, the image of Toronto, in some ways it does look very futuristic, but there's also a kind of an image of it as being very atomized and hyper-competitive. It's both multicultural, but also sterile. So your overall thoughts on Toronto and Canada as a post-national nation?
Yeah, this is why I like you as like a person that I met online, because you really, really got everything. All the points I would surmise on my timeline for that and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a Commonwealth country where you kind of cryogenically freeze yourself and your family, and you come here to live, work, and die. And, you know, it's a great place to come where you want to, like, flee inflation or, like, really banana republic sort of corruption. But at the same time, it's just like, they're a Commonwealth country, but they're kind of like, there's a sterility to it. It's very multi-culti, but you just lose some of that. I have to say, I'm also rather prejudiced, seeing as I came here 2019. That's rather
recent. You're born in America, North Carolina.
Yeah, I was born and raised in North Carolina. I was born and raised in a military town, even though my parents weren't military. They're physicians at the VA hospital. They dealt with a lot of veterans and stuff. But like, yeah, I do agree with Gio, like the artist guy on Twitter, that Canada is indeed a post-national country, for sure, for all the reasons mentioned.
Also, like, politically, it's the American left idealizes Canada, but it's also like peak neoliberalism, especially Toronto, but the government and Trudeau as a whole.
Yeah, it's like, this is why I don't identify with the left, because in its current incarnation, it's like current state, it's been like basically Fabianism for a long time. They want this like top-down elitist driven sort of social change that requires class collaborationism, and also is almost Malthusianist and really Machiavellian, and just like really sterile and mechanical and just like completely antithetical to all of the things I value and cherish. It's just like, yeah, so of course they like this, because people here are like, they love the rules. I don't know. There's like this weird thing where a Canadian liberal snubs and looks down on Americans, but they import all of their cultural content, for the most part, from the same people they deem Philistines. And it's like, you guys, America's your biggest trading partner. You will have more in common with America than the UK. Like, I don't understand why you're looking down on your trading partner, you know, that you get a lot of your cultural influence from. Like, it's obscene. It's like, it's absurd, you know? It's weird to me.
Yeah, you do talk about, like, urbanism on Twitter. And I'm not sure if you're referencing Toronto. Like, I mean, Toronto does seem... It was probably much more sterile than New York. New York probably has more
character. Oh, yeah, there's a buzz in New York, for sure.
Sorry. But I guess just kind of talking about, like, urbanism in general, especially from an American perspective, like, a lot of places there's, like, a lack of shared public spaces. Like, you basically have to drive, you go to your job, you do errands at a store, then you go home to your single-family home or to your apartment, and there's just a lack of, like, shared public spaces. Kind of the idealized image of Europe, so kind of how you say, like, loitering is good. And then also, malls are dying out, but there's this sort of 80s nostalgia, the Heidemall culture, how malls did serve as a public space. And then another
thing
I saw...
Yeah, those are the new Victorian mansions.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Then you also... Yeah. I think another thing is, like, I remember talking about this on a past show, but you retweeted something about the appeal to Disneyland and to other theme parks, like even Vegas, is it's an otherworldly aura, but it's also one of the truly walkable places.
Yeah, exactly. Like, people, I think that's, as much as, you know, as much as there is a lot of more space in the States and everything, you know, the way our cities are laid out are different. People are really craving public space. And when you take that away from them, it's just like a really disastrous thing. And that's why people have Disney brain, I think. I agreed with that person, because there's just like a lack of public space. And even though, say for instance, I personally wouldn't idealize living in Singapore, because I like the occasional cigar, and, you know, they get some shit right? Like, whether it's considering housing a really important social good, they're kind of distributist in that way. They really care about people having individual ownership over their space, even if it's with 90-year contracts or whatever. I mean, they still technically pretty much own their home. And the fact that there's like a lot of gardens and meeting spaces, and when you take away brick and mortar experience, I mean, the mall isn't perfect, right? Like, it
used to be like fashionable in the 80s and 90s to sort of bash the mall. But now that it's gone, like, people are lamenting
it's
the loss
better
of that
than
space.
Exactly. It's like shit is consistently getting worse, and I'm nostalgic for a time where it was normal for people to gather in that space, even if it was a money pit of sorts. And it's just like, yeah, it's kind of fucked. Like, that's basically what a huge percentage of online discourse is. It's like nostalgia for stuff that we would have criticized back then, but now shit has gotten so fucking bleak that we're nostalgic over stuff that we would have criticized 15 years ago. It's really strange and bizarre how the goalposts change and shift, and like what we're realizing we forgot we valued. And but yeah, I mean, in regards to the mall, there are other people who have thought about this too. I believe Jack from the Perfume Nationalist.
Oh,
has
we had him on.
Expounded.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's talked about the mall as well, and you know, I've thought about this too. But yeah, there's just like a lack of spaces to loiter in, and it's really disturbing. You could get a ticket at any point in time, it seems like you can't park anywhere, you can't sit anywhere. I mean, I wonder when parks are gonna be like bye-bye. Like,
yeah,
I just,
I know what you mean. Yeah, I somewhat inspired by a show that Robert and I did with Jack from the Perfume Nationalist last year. I wrote a blog post about this issue of, I think I was talking about public spaces, but also sort of the idea of public aesthetics, like things that are built
the political symbolism, how, like, I forget the context, but, like, say, like, a mansion is a symbolism of power in an individualistic sense, and how ascetics,
yeah,
they symbolize power, and they also symbolize social cohesion. Like, what an architectural site symbolizes for a society.
Yeah, like, obviously architecture has always been about throwing around power, like, whether it's funded by the government or a private institution. If you're putting a building together, if you build a building, if you build a mall, whatever the case might be, it's a way of asserting a certain amount of power and wealth on your own part. But there's a way of doing that, like, in an older form of capitalism. Say what you will about capitalism in general, but in an older form of capitalism than the type we have today, there's this idea of building something that the public can enjoy, whether, a mall being a great example, where it's funded by corporate,
it's kind of how something that was once seen as hyper-consumerist and hyper-capitalist, like a mall, is now seen as a beacon for communitarianism.
Yeah, there's the word I'm using in the blog was, there's a certain noblesse oblige, I don't even know how you pronounce that, but the powerful people nevertheless feeling like something is owed, that they actually care about, they actually feel the need to interact with lower social strata, even if that was just to get their money. At the very least, there was a relation between, like, the upper class and the middle class. And what you have nowadays is increasingly just a totally isolated, 1% or upper class that simply seeks to not interact at all with not only the lower classes, but even the middle class.
Yeah.
Yeah, importance of kind of aesthetics and urbanism in politics. So say, like, in a bimbo caliphate, what policies would you like to see? What would you subsidize? And are there going to be female comedians in the caliphate?
Oh, that thing that's my pinned video. So I said that because I just think women are funny in different ways as an aggregate whole. And it's true that most female comedians are, I'd say pretty much all, are basically shit because they talk about their bodily fluids all the time. They're not like Maria Bamford or like even a Lisa Limpinelli or a Joan Rivers. It's just fucking
talking about like the wave of kind of like woke or feminist female comedians of the 2010s, like including like even like Amy Schumer.
I mean, I just think like funny women who are funny in that peacocky way.
The best comedy is either dark humor or about some kind of situational humor. Like, Larry David obviously is hilarious. I think a lot of the female comedians, it's just, maybe it's overtly silly, but there's all, it's that. But specifically to the sort of 2010s era, but I think, or that they're overly, they're, a lot of them are overtly politicized or moralistic.
Well, yeah, and I also just think, like, as an aggregate whole, I think women and men just kind of have different senses of humor. Like, you know, in order for a dude to go get laid, like, this can be fucking rehashed 2010, 2011 manosphere take, but, like, part of it's humor, you know? Like, part of it is fucking being funny, especially if you're not retardedly good-looking. You crack a joke or two. And then for a woman, I feel like the best sort of humor they have, generally speaking, is more of a, satirical sort of, good writing skill or sharp wit for wit dialogue is just what I've noticed. And that might sound like a fucking stupid, hackneyed, evo psych take, but it's a trend I notice, and I think that a lot of people intuitively notice too. And I don't think necessarily a woman's humor translates best on a stage. And I don't think most stand-up comedians are fucking good in the first place. Most are fucking terrible. Like, most stand-up comedy, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah, I'd say the same with films. Like, I used to enjoy comedy, and, but most, I'd say, like, most of the new comedy films suck.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, also, people are scared to make people laugh anymore.
I did see Tim
Dillon making people laugh, but
yeah, Matt and I were thinking about maybe doing a show on this, but as interesting as It's kind of how there's two new horror films as part of a series on there on Hulu. So I think there's the one Spree, and then there's another one called I'm just fucking with you, and they're both dark comedies that play off of sort of online culture like 4chan and incel culture. So Spree's about a guy who goes on a rampage across LA. So he's like a streamer, and he's also like a live streamer, and then he's also like an Uber driver. And then the other one, I'm just fucking with you, is that one's about a guy who's kind of a depressed loner who stays at a motel, and he gets kind of trapped into these like pranks, and it's also a dark comedy slash horror. And the guy who runs it, he ends up being a serial killer. I noticed like there is like a lot of crappy comedy, but Spree is like totally nihilistic, but just about like the dark humor. But with I'm Just Fucking With You, that one I think there is a bit. It's still I enjoyed it, but there is a bit of a playoff of like toxic masculinity. I recommend watching most of those films, but dark comedy is a separate genre. But most of the main like top comedy films that have came out in the last 5 years are garbage.
Yeah, I mean I'll definitely check that out. I've been trying to binge more on. I want to watch Heaven's Gate because I haven't had the patience to yet. It's 5 fucking hours, and then I want to watch the Apocalypse Now Redux, like the 3 hour long one. But I actually really like it when people invite me to talk about film, because I think I say everything I need to say about what I think the political economy is in this day and age. Like I bet people are bored of what I have to say, honestly. But yeah, no, I'll check out those films.
Yeah, no, Spree is. I haven't seen I'm Just Fucking With You, but Spree is a good one for like anyone in our.
Wasn't he on one of the Dirtbag Left podcasts? So I'm just fucking with you. That one. Oh yeah, he was on Jack. So
yeah.
He seems a bit kind of Dirtbag Left. So I'm Just Fucking With You. That one was by the director who did he did The Purge. The director from The Purge.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll definitely check that out. Yeah, but the people who are funny now, I mean, quite frankly, a lot of them are on a podcasting circuit, whether it's Tim Dillon or fucking Nick. Why am I having a brain? I don't know if it's the Cosmo I had or whatever, but what's the guy's name? Nick Mullen. What the hell is wrong with me? Yeah, Nick Mullen.
All right.
Nick Mullen, yeah, I think Nick Mullen is one of the guys of our time, to be quite honest with you. That guy is fucking hilarious. Like, any racial stereotype, anything, he's fucking good at it. He really has it down. That's why the best comedians now are usually disgruntled Irish, the people of Irish background. I don't know. Yeah, like... Scott's Irish background. Yeah, they're the new Jewish males of the 2010s, 2020s.
Never thought of that, but I know what you mean. I mean, I'm not really sure what Sam Hyde... I figure Sam Hyde's probably Irish. And then, what's that other guy who's on?
Louis C.K., I think, is, like, Jewish and Irish. I mean, but he got, yeah.
He looks like fucking Lenin.
A lot of Louis C.K.'s show was pretty funny. But I noticed, like, right when Louis C.K. had the incident, that's, like, was the turning point when comedy was completely garbage.
Yeah, and he was such a gentleman about it, too. He, like, asked to jerk off in front of you.
Yeah.
I don't understand why he got in trouble at all. He asked beforehand. It's not like he just fucking took... It's, you're degenerate if you take out your ding-a-ling and you jerk off without asking. But if you ask, you, like... You know, I would think, like, he's a weird, odd duck, but he asked beforehand, and I said yes. So why is he in fucking trouble? I don't know.
Yeah, or to the extent that he's in trouble anyway.
He's getting shows, man. This is the thing. If you do not apologize, this is the best thing for any man today. You need to have a scandal, and then you need to not apologize, and then you get, like, even more notoriety and better women. It's, like, the best thing. So just learn from that. John Ossoff needs that because he had a fucking the lamest, gayest TikTok video. He needs to have a scandal and then he can just like, you know, he'll be so much cooler.
There's all this talk about like about gender issues, but to what degree are a lot of the gender wars, how much of this is just, well, there's a hype on social media, but how much of this, of these issues are economic? And do you think there's a PMC matriarchy? And are women the perfect neoliberal subject?
This is so funny because like, people bring up the women as being the neoliberal subject all the time. I think the future we're headed for is one that is ultimately the inauthentic existence of Dasein. Did I say that right? Anyways, but basically, it's seemingly gynocratic, right? Because what we see with the post-industrial economy is women... It's the sort of service industry jobs that are quite frankly more attuned to a traditionally female skill set, right?
Oh, like HR or anything in the, the managerial sector.
Exactly, and women like to run shit like that. Okay, that's why I want to be a party planner. But the thing is, it's so easy to hate on these women, right? But that's just because the economy is benefiting them in that way right now. A lot of these women are sad in their like day-to-day lives. And I mean, I think a lot of men online are like, oh, you're going to die when you're fucking 31 and your eggs are going to run out. No, a lot of those women are going to stay attractive because they have the money to stay attractive and they're going to date and everything. But trust and believe, this atomization and hyper-individualism affects and hurts all of us because after those service industry jobs get gaped or whatever, which they will, there's going to be a new wave of this shit. I mean, like, the future we're headed for is... I wrote this down somewhere. Let me look for it because it articulated it better than whatever I am saying right now. It's called Replacement of Women.
So this is taking into account, like, all these trends. These trends are, like, in automation.
Yeah, automation, but, you know, right now, I think a lot, like, ever since the, I said this imbalance will ultimately hurt women, both men and women, even though women appear to be thriving in our managerialist, seemingly gynocentric technocracy, this will ultimately give way to a still managerialist, yet increasingly androgynous environment of worker drones with no feminine or masculine essence whatsoever. Countless corporate campaigns now claim to speak on behalf of women with the aim of convincing them that devoting themselves to work and deferring love and family is liberating, when in reality this mainly serves corporate interests. What we will ultimately see is the melding of hierarchies, all data and people centralized in very few spots. For very few employers, people will rely less on strong familial and friendship bonds and more on work, as well as the segmentation, commoditization, and purchase of intimate interactions via the technosphere, specifically human-generated environments online, whether that be sex work, therapy, dating, non-fungible tokens or friendship, and gig economy. A world with short hair and pantsuits and IKEA cells and down-tempo music and lab-made diets, and for everyone to eliminate any form of joy not derived from serving the employer or shareholder. A transhumanistic death cult where people fear emotional connection and are terrified of the real thing. You'll have men who bang a robot and order off of Uber Eats, and women scared of catching feelings with their vibrators and ordering off of Grubhub. In many ways, what I just described isn't a vision of the future. This is a hyper-real now.
Yeah, it seems to be... already here, so like a lot of the manosphere types, I mean, that scene is basically pretty dead, but like 5 years ago they were mostly talking about like issues like feminism, but I think the technological aspects, that's really the number one issue as far as like transforming society. And under the pandemic, these trends have been even more accelerated. People scared to leave their homes because of the lockdown, but even after the pandemic is over, I think it will accelerate these trends where people are atomized, spending all their time indoors or online, and then just like ordering everything on Uber Eats. And like, what is the end game of all of this? Like, do you see people kind of like deemed useless and turned into husks, like living in pods and hooked up to like Soylent or in the tech sphere?
Well, yeah, in some ways, like, and in some macabre way, like, the way I'm looking at it is understanding the contradictions of the political economy through Marxian critique and through, like, whatever Dugin talks about. So it's, like, from a range of sources. And Agamben was really good at noticing security theater as well. But what I think we're ended up for, the end state is people relegated to the virtual, like the virtual option, like the mold Moldbuggian sort of virtual option where they're stuck inside of like a sarcophagus-like structure with, you know, shit being pumped through their veins and they're like online constantly.
I interviewed Robin Hanson. He's like a futurist writer about the concept of people's consciousness being uploaded onto AI and then just being, just being kind of, for most people, they're just being kind of stored. That could be where we're headed.
Yeah, you know,
the,
like
even
people,
like the meme about living in a pod and eating bugs and so or Soylent.
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically in line with what a lot of futurists are thinking about, because this is where it is just like kind of always oriented. Like, there's this guy named Zoltan.
Isfahan?
Zoltan. Isfahan. Oh wow! See, this is why I knew you were a good egg, because like you fucking seem on it. Yeah. So he's basically brought certain shit to light that I'm like, oh, I could see this happening. Dmitry Orlov has as well, in terms of ultimately, I think this is all like sort of a top. Like, first of all, it is the egregore of technocapital. Like, the you know. This is just like naturally what occurs when the whole project is boundless growth and all built on debt, and like also just like, you know, trying to help profit margins, right? Like, it's just, this is just what happens. But I also think like there is a lot of elite, like top down, you know?
Like the conspiracy theorist who view everything as, they view everything as this tiny shadowy elite, everything is top down.
That's silly.
That's,
and
overly,
it's like,
yeah, it's overly simplistic. It's sort of a movie, like I'm kind of a movie-based view of the world. It's like there's this overall, technology creates this kind of overall power apparatus.
No, it's more of a rhizomatic assemblage of NGOs and corporations and stuff. I don't think it's like any one specific group of people. I think it's like all different types of elites. You know, you can't like attribute it to like, oh, only one certain group and stuff. But ultimately, it's just like, it's kind of all over the place, but, you know, from a general stratum of society. And, you know, there's the PMC, as everybody likes to talk about, who are kind of in some ways the conduit for this plan to occur. And most of these people don't understand. They just want to keep their standard of living up and whatever, and they're willing to do whatever it takes. But yeah, I do think the end goal is pretty fucking bleak, but there's going to be a lot of shit that transpires in between, whether like the ectogenesis that I speak of, where people are making their babies in vats, or like, you know, just like this worship of state ideology and just like more atomization.
So like, what do you make of something like the Great Reset? And then do you think wokeness is just sort of like a state ideology or ideology of the PMC class, managerial class?
Yeah, I think it is like the ideology of that class, because that's what the thing is now. But the thing about capital is that it can co-opt any sort of ideology. It's just like in this stage in the political economy, that is what it is co-opting. And it's crazy, because I think we all thought when we were in college and stuff that it would just be relegated to this weird monastic class of academics, but it's trickled to your workplace and everything.
I think it did exist about a decade ago, but it was unique to college, to academia.
Yeah, and I used to think like, oh, this is just for this like monastic class of people in academia, but it's macabre when you go to your big four consulting firm or your office, and then people are, you know, and it's nefarious too, because it means that the societies of control are really fine-tuned and really like precise, and it paints itself as like this very good and noble and nice thing when it actually is like mystifying power and stuff. And
totally.
I think that's what's it's much. I want to think of it more as 2004 Bush instead of 2021 Bush.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like different, but it's ultimately serving the same cause.
You mean what, like, was this? I'm just curious. 2004 Bush being like not a very likable character, but at least it's
you knew what the fuck was going on. Yeah. And yeah, now he's like painting people, and then he's
it's
like,
amazing how the kind of revisionist history, how all these how the left was viewed him, and rightfully so. I mean, Iraq War was a disaster, and the Patriot Act, a violation of civil liberties. But now, like, everything is, it's pretty disgusting how these, like, figures, liberal figures, have rehabilitated George Bush. Whatever you think about, like, Trump, I mean, I'm not a huge Trump fan, but I mean, but obviously Trump is not that bad if you compare him to George Bush.
So I think that, you know, I don't think like anyone was our God and savior. I think that the K Street blob neuters people in like 73 days.
Sure.
You know, Assange was right about that, and I think anyone with an iota of a brain would know that. But the thing with Trump was he kind of staved off shit. He was a cultural fuck you. Like, not really sophisticated.
Just kind of like as a middle finger to the establishment. That was like the reason to vote for Trump.
Yeah, he was like Bernie 2016 in that way. They were both a middle finger, and one in some way was at least talking about trade. Okay, so you know that was nice. But the thing with Bernie is, he was a bit, you know. The thing with him was he got, like, berated by NGO hags and, like the most fucking – and activists who I hate activists. And because of that, he was basically neutered in a far more, you know, deleterious way.
It happened to – both the Trump movement, how they went from, like, populism and nationalism to maybe closer to conservatism. And then you saw that with the Bernie movement – like, being a progressive used to be, like, during the Occupy Wall Street era, like, it seems like we were going to see, like, a progressive or left populist movement. And now all these people, like AOC, supporting Joe Biden and cancel culture are just a total joke.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing with Occupy Wall Street, what was nefarious about that was Obama was working in conjunction with the Department of... He was working with DHS, and he was working with local municipal police departments to quell that down. And the thing is, it's kind of true. Like, as beautiful as Occupy Wall Street was, and mind you, I was way younger, you know, when this happened. I was in sixth grade when I saw this play out. I was like, what's the plan here? Like, there's really no plan. I mean, they're sitting outside, and that's nice, but, like, what's going to happen? And
like his drum circles.
Yeah, and mind you, this is what someone who's like 12 years old is thinking. Like, imagine somebody who's like a fucking adult, you know, who might be questioning this. I don't fucking know. But like, it was very disturbing how quickly that got quelled. And I think people really underestimate how powerful or how, you know, sophisticated it is. From, yes, the executive office holds power, but, like, you know, there's a bunch of intelligence agencies. And in some ways, I actually think now the Biden administration is just like the outcrop of the Obama administration. And I'm sure Obama is counseling Biden, like, in confidence and, like, phone calls and stuff. And I'm pretty sure Obama is intelligence. What is he doing? Like, I think it's... The menthol cigarettes thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like the clove cigarettes.
I'm not that much of like a tinfoil hat wearer, but over, especially over the past couple of years, even, you know, I first got into this whole like dissident scene for reasons that didn't really have to do with conspiracy theories, but, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist, but the more you look into it, the more you realize that basically all the seemingly paranoid things people say about intelligence agencies and their relationship with the media and the way
or that, Zika mosquitoes, like, what the fuck? Yeah. I don't want to think this way. I want to be fucking normal, okay? I want to be, like, I want to be a normal woman. Like, it's just, but people are forcing me not to, so I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
but
like, I don't think the CIA determines everything. I just think that, yes, they have their hand in a hell of a lot, and specifically with the whole idea of narrative control. I think that's fairly, whatever the political narrative is, I think is often very much planned and presented in very disingenuous ways.
We're at the end of the show. Bimbo, is there anything else you'd like to add, and do you want to plug your social media sites?
Yeah, sure, why not? Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having me on, but yeah, I'm Bimbo Ubermensch on Twitter, and my Instagram, well, you know, you can just organically find my Instagram. I'm just trying to keep, people will know, but yeah, but I don't sell anything except doodles, which comes straight from my id. I sold one doodle.
For some reason, they remind me of the show Super Jail on Adult Swim. That's just a coincidence.
Oh, really? Yeah, you know, I could see that. Somebody said that my drawing with the anthropomorphic sushi, like the anthropomorphic California roll, it, like, almost looked Earthbound-esque. So I was just like, oh, that's nice. But I sold Yakub at the strip club. That was fun. If you like my doodles, you can hit me up. And when I learn how to mint an NFT, although I'll probably get, you know, a competent man teach me how to mint an NFT. I don't know how the fuck to do that. I have doodles though. But yeah, I've been doing that as a method of meditation. Yeah, automatic drawing. But thank you for having me on. Y'all are so sweet.
Bimbo Ubermensch, a great show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you. It was so nice to meet you guys both. Thank you for dealing with my rambling. Bye.
Great to talk.